listening to Decolonize Social Work, a conversation about social work, oppression, and liberation. I'm your co-host, Ondine.
And I'm your co-host, Drew.
Well, here we are.
Hello.
Hi.
Old friends.
Indeed.
We've gotten some new friends in the lull between episodes, too.
Yeah, I really love like how much this podcast is sparking conversation.
Yeah. All over the world?
All over the world.
Yeah. We're big in Australia.
Yeah.
Not really.
No. But we've had folks from Australia reach out to us about the content and telling us that they're listening and it's sparking conversation. So that's been really neat.
No, it's been awesome. So for whatever apology we owe, apologies for the gap. I've had some things going on. I've changed jobs twice.
That's a lot.
Since the last episode. It is a lot. I left the job I was at when we started this podcast, and then the job I left actually had an opening for a higher up position, so I applied for that and went back to that position.
It's a little flip flopping.
But yeah, I just started that job a couple of weeks ago, so it kind of has allowed to recenter and get focused on this.
That's a lot to think about.
It is. What have you been doing?
Well, I am working on getting my certification to be a sexuality educator.
Nice.
And so I am currently in supervision. So I am, you know, looking for opportunities to do sexuality education with people in the community. Been putting together some stuff, facilitating some groups. Yeah, I've put a lot of energy into that lately.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. I feel like I'm learning a lot. I'm, you know, lifelong learning is a thing.
It is a thing.
It is a thing.
It is a thing.
It's fun, too. I like these conversations.
Yeah. Have you been doing anything else?
Gosh, probably.
I mean, I know you said that's fun and that's something you want to do, but, like, is there something that's just, like, mindlessly fun that you've been doing?
Yes.
I'm putting you on the spot.
You are.
I know.
Yes. So, okay. I hope folks will be okay with going down this short detour, but
there's not giving them a choice.
No, I'm not. There's this amazing fast food restaurant called Taco Bell. It is one of my favorites. And recently, Taco Bell released that they were going to be eliminating approximately 10 items from their menu on September 12th. So you've been a part of this project.
I have.
I thought it would be a great idea to sample those items and write reviews and put this together as a zine, which you cleverly title Sunset Menu at Taco Bell.
The Taco Bell Sunset Menu.
Yeah. So actually, in the last couple of weeks, I have been eating a lot of fast food and taking photos of food that all looks the same. And
at least in the photos, it didn't.
That's true.
In person.
I feel like I've been drinking a lot of water because my sodium intake's been so high. I'm just really excited to share this with the world. Thank you so much for giving me a platform to talk about this.
That's what we do here.
So yeah, sex ed and Taco Bell. That's what I've been up to.
That relates to so many people. So many people can connect to that.
Mm-hmm. If you live in a place where there is not access to Taco Bell, that's maybe good because maybe that means the nasty reach of capitalism hasn't gotten to your corner. It also means that you haven't been able to taste the delicious, delicious,
salty, savoriness.
Goodness.
What was your favorite thing that you tried that is on the Sunset Menu?
Well, I've got to be honest. Most of those things are nothing to write home about.
Hammer.
With as much as I enjoy Taco Bell, I wasn't eating those things, so that says something. But I will say, well, firstly, I want people to read the zine, so I can't
give
actually, it all away.
I just realized I asked you that, but will this spoil things when the zine comes out?
There is one item that I am actually sad to see go. But again, you can read all about it when the zine is ready. I don't really know how people will get a copy of that. I'll just have to figure that out.
It's too bad there's just not this vast information network that we can't distribute this through.
Yeah, I don't know how you get things to people.
I have no idea. Someday.
Someday.
We'll be living a time that you can actually connect everybody.
Yeah.
From everybody's home and
pockets. What a time that will be.
I can't wait for the future. So we're not here to just talk about Taco Bell, though, as much as I could probably talk about Taco Bell for the duration of the episode. We mentioned this in the little blurb we had to let everybody know that we're still alive. and that this podcast is still alive, which is cutely what we say when we say decolonization. What are we talking about when we talk about decolonizing social work? And in some ways, I guess you could think of this as maybe the episode that we should have had first, right?
I was just going to say that.
Yeah.
We have so much to talk about today, and I think it's really important. And yeah, this probably should have gone before our other episodes. So I'm glad we're doing it now. And if you're recommending this podcast to a friend, maybe have them listen to this one first.
So we're going to be talking about... Undine just looked at me like, okay, when are you going in? What we're going to be talking about, again, is the foundation of what we mean by decolonization. Not really what we mean, but what people before us have written about and discussed and theorized about the concept of decolonization and how that affects not just the way we move through the world individually, but also our society, and ultimately, for the purpose of this podcast, how this informs or doesn't inform social work.
Mm-hmm.
So that said, I don't know. I was thinking, just diving right in, what is the basis of decolonization at its very just like most ground level understanding?
Well, actually, first I just wanted to mention that we're going to reference several different texts and websites, and we'll make sure that those links are available on our social media. I don't want anyone to feel like they have to frantically grab a pen and jot some the titles down. So there's that. We're going to provide a transcript to this episode. It'll be available on our website, so I just want to lift that up too. We, in our research for this episode, have... come to an understanding around there being this very base definition of decolonization, but the purpose of also bringing in some of these perspectives from a variety of authors and sources is to highlight that there's a broad conversation around decolonization too, and that in some ways there's probably a spectrum of agreement and disagreement. I don't know if that makes sense about what it actually means, the process of decolonization. So I just want to lift that up.
So what is the base definition that we've come to understand as decolonization from some of the things that we've been reading about this?
Well, let me start then with the first thing that I dug into. And it's a paper called Decolonization is Not a Metaphor by Eve Tuck and K. Wayne Yang. And as I've been researching more, I find that this is one of those articles that everybody is looking toward.
It's kind of a cornerstone of this discussion, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And so I think, and you chime in, but some of the major points that are made in this article, the biggest point is that decolonization is about returning land to indigenous people. And it is not a metaphor. It is not a metaphor for social justice. Or, you know, it's not synonymous with social justice or synonymous with anti-imperialist work. The, you know, activism and work that would be called social justice work can live alongside decolonization, but the end goals might be different. So you can't talk about decolonizing if you don't talk about returning land to indigenous people.
Yeah. And I think that's a definition that is shared throughout some of the other things. One of the, I guess, more famous decolonization texts, Wretched of the Earth by Frantz Fanon, has been the baseline. Like this paper, Decolonization is Not a Metaphor, even leads with two excerpts from Wretched of the Earth because it's considered to be like the groundwork for decolonization theory. And that Fanon also says decolonization at its most direct is about the return of stolen land to indigenous mm-hmm. people. So you said a good point, too, about how this isn't synonymous with social justice. And that took me a long time to kind of read through and process and kind of understand it. Because just to remind everybody, too, I've come to understand that not only do I have a white identity and a privileged identity, I also have a settler identity. And there's been a lot of talk between us off of the podcast about what does that mean? And ultimately getting around to a thing of it not being something that immediately instills shame in you. There might be some guilt about what has happened, but the shame as to quote somebody else who we're going to talk about, Anna Sewell, who did this webinar for Everyday Feminism called Practical Decolonization, she said, shame is a tool of colonization.
Yeah, I know. And, you know, social workers love them some Brené Brown.
Yeah.
So in case you haven't heard, Brené Brown is a social work researcher, and her work is specifically around shame. And it was from her that I first heard this distinction made. Mm-hmm. This may also come from others, so I want to lift that up. But she talks about shame being about feeling bad about who you are, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas guilt is feeling bad about
what you did.
What you did.
Yeah.
And that distinction is really important because people aren't motivated often to change or to action through shaming tactics. And when they are, it's to avoid feeling the nasty feeling of shame, but not actually might be to do the right thing or to really grow.
Mm-hmm.
So Drew and I were talking about how there's a lot of shame with accepting a settler identity. And we have to figure out ways, those of us who are settlers, to accept that and take responsibility for it, but not get so bogged down in the shame of it that we're not motivated towards action, or we actually motivate ourselves towards actions which aren't helpful and don't move towards decolonization.
For me too, it kind of, that work or process was analogous to a lot of the work I've done with white folks of trying to understand that being white and being told you have privilege isn't somebody trying to shame you for something. It's an acknowledgement of just an unearned benefit you have, and that maybe there's a responsibility to use that as well, mm-hmm. to help dismantle systems that, while they've given you benefits, have also been at the expense of other people where those benefits have been withheld, but also those people have been targeted with the opposite of benefits, which is oppression and violence and agony and hunger.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, that helped understand it a little bit, of that analogy of like working through like the white guilt feelings and kind of coming around to that, and the white shame kind of
working
also
through the settler guilt, mm-hmm, and settler exactly. shame feelings. And, you know, we also chatted in preparation for this article about, well, what does it mean for us to talk about decolonization as settlers? And I want to get into that a little bit more about the sort of how my personal experience with like processing that as an identity. But one thing that we agreed upon was that just like it's the work of white folks to talk about racism and resist white supremacy and to not put the burden on folks of color and black people in particular to teach them what to do and how to be, it is the responsibility of those of us who are settlers to be pushing this conversation and to be doing the work of decolonization.
Yeah. Yeah. So you mentioned too, lifting up something about these texts that we've read and like that concept of decolonization. Like, I just want to own outright that these aren't original theories or ideas that we've had. This is the work of indigenous folks that we're talking about today. And Frantz Fanon was, I forget where he was from,
Martinique,
yeah, that's right. And he had worked in Algerian Liberation Front in Northern Africa, and so he had been involved with a lot. He was also part of a colonized people as well. But yeah, so all of this thinking, all of this thought, all of this construction is from indigenous work, and I just want to lift that up and acknowledge we're talking about this work today, but make no mistake, this is only possible because of the hard work that's been done in the text that we're going to be talking about today.
And I want to add too that, you know, like we try to do at the end of each episode and kind of more tightly tie this to social work, we intend to do that today. But I just want to name right now that I have seen decolonization. I've seen this word a lot in conferences. I've seen macro social workers talking about this, social justice educators, and we need to know what the heck we're talking about. And that's part of this conversation today, is that if you don't know as a social worker that decolonization is about returning stolen land, then you probably shouldn't be using that word.
Right. And I think there might be some folks who are confused about that too. It's like, if decolonization is about stolen land, then how does that work into the framework of social work? Because I think social work as a profession, as a practice, might actually be incompatible with decolonization.
Yeah.
it exists in this country of stolen, unceded land to do good stuff in theory and a lot of times in practice, but you can't overlook the fact that all of it is happening on land that is unrecognized and that was unlawfully taken from people.
And that a lot of social work practice, and I think the foundation for some social work, it was, you know, it was imported from white Europe. So we were chatting on a dog walk about Elizabethan poor laws.
The worthy poor.
You know, anybody who, most folks who've been through social work school at some point had to read and learn about that, but that there were these like specific ways of defining who is poor and who deserves and doesn't deserve charity. And that is still very alive and well in the way we do social work.
Right. And so if it's hard to even reconcile social work with a decolonized movement, why are we even talking about it? You know, so I kind of worked with this in my head about like, what does it even mean to decolonize social work if inherently you can never decolonize it? And I think more broadly, and we're going to talk about this, about some folks who have written a lot of great stuff about decolonization. I think rather than thinking of how we can decolonize social work, I think we have to address the symptoms of colonization within social work to eventually lead toward decolonization. Would you say that's about accurate?
Yeah. So I just want to summarize what you're saying and tell me if I'm wrong. But basically what you're saying is that it is possible that social work practice as we know it is not ultimately compatible with decolonization. And firstly, that has to be okay. We have to sit in that tension and be okay with it.
Yeah. It's always going to be a settler practice.
And that secondly, then, that doesn't mean that we don't try to move towards decolonization in our social work practice.
Right. Because there are things that are tools of colonization, like the disconnection or disconnecting of people from communities. Capitalism's a big one we've talked about. These are things that we can address. White supremacy culture, absolutely. Misogyny. These are things that through social work we can address, but these have to be in the movement towards decolonization, which is far beyond the goals of social work.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, decolonization ultimately would see that the stolen land is returned to the indigenous people that it was taken from.
Mm-hmm.
So that said, we're going to juggle all the social work stuff alongside of decolonization and try to help you understand how understanding decolonization will help out with your social work practice. But like you said, it's not possible to actually have a decolonized social work practice.
Not here. Not in the United States. And I just want to create some space too for the fact that we've learned there are listeners from all over the world. So I would love to hear other folks' perspectives, particularly the perspectives of indigenous people doing social work and what that looks like and sort of your reflections on what we're talking about.
Like doing social work, indigenous folks doing social work on their land.
Where they live. Yeah, on their land.
Yeah, I know. That would be interesting because it almost seems like I would wonder what the decolonization work looks like at that point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when
mm-hmm.
it's not, when the land is already there. So what next?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of would help maybe be a guide for what happens for us here. So, okay. So we've talked about decolonization is not a metaphor. And I mentioned a couple of other things. Why don't we just kind of sit in that Tuck and Yang article for a minute? I mentioned this a second ago. This was a really hard read.
Oh my gosh. So yeah.
And not academically, like I could read it, even though it is kind of dense, but it just brought a lot of feelings up for me that I think I hadn't been privy to or exposed to or had reflected on a lot. And it was funny. Like I said, I understand it through an analogy of working through white identity. And I know a lot about that. And it was weird just to know what happens when people are confronted with uncomfortable truths and that kind of work.
Mm-hmm.
And then to also be taken off guard by those same sorts of things, like the guilt, the denial, the defensiveness. It's, you know, all that stuff kind of happened for me. And eventually, you know, I read this like, I don't know, 3 weeks ago, and it took that long for me to kind of stew in it. And I'm still not, I wouldn't say I've mastered it, right? But I've accepted it. And I think that's like the big part for me is understanding like, this is a really big, big thing to be grappling with.
I'm having a similar experience, right?
In
processing my feelings around this. Firstly, I recommend everybody read it. You know, something else I want to just lift up
as we dig into how this article made us feel, is that, and I may have mentioned, you may have mentioned Dr. Adrian Keene on previous podcasts. I just can't remember. We talk about so much.
I don't know. It's been a long time since our last recording. Remind everybody who Adrian Keene is.
So Dr. Keene is an Indigenous scholar here in our country, in the United States. And she's the co-host of a podcast called All My Relations, which I just adore. I feel so privileged to get to hear them talk on that podcast. But one of the very first things she said on the podcast, All My Relations, is that early in her career, someone shared with her this concept or this idea of consenting to learn in public. And I am trying to embrace that. And I'm trying to embrace that through our podcast, really, because this is some scary shit to get to record yourself kind of processing aloud your thoughts and your feelings. And I'm always afraid I'm going to say the wrong thing and piss everybody off and then get canceled or something. And then I have to remember that I have to do this work, and it's important to do it publicly because that's how I hold myself accountable. And it's okay if people call me in because I've misstepped. What matters is how I respond to those missteps.
Yeah.
So this is something I encourage you guys also to sit with and embrace, is this idea of consenting to learn in public. And that doesn't mean you're consenting to being abused by people. You know, it's not the same as, like, you know, letting folks pile on and reduce you to a shame puddle.
Mm-hmm.
But this is me saying, I might say some fucked up shit on this podcast today, and it's because I'm a learner. And I will apologize and own it.
That's so hard. Oh,
so
my God.
Hard. But oh, you know, here's the thing. If we are social workers who care about social work, then we also have to model what it is to bumble forward and grow.
I think that's one of the things, not just that's important to decolonization and understanding this, but to being just decent social worker is to walk in humility, mm-hmm. to understand that you're gonna fuck up. I think I told you the other day, like, I feel like the more information I get about decolonization, the less I feel like I know.
You're just sitting around confused.
I know.
All the time.
I'm just like, nothing, I don't know what anything means, and it all should just go away. And I just, and it's good, and I accept it, and that's what it should do. Eve Tuck and Kay Wayne Yang talk about how decolonization is an unsettling, and it's literally unsettling. It's removing the settlers from the land, but I read that in two ways. It's unsettling in the feeling you get, too.
Yeah.
That it unsettles your core. It unsettles the peace that you have, or you're able to. And I think, again, that's a good thing, but you just have to kind of be courageous enough to accept it and not let it scare you off of this work.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's mm-hmm. just, again, you're going to move away from decolonization as a goal, and more likely you're going to reinforce settler colonial frameworks and harm through your social work.
So one of the points in this article, man, you're drinking that water.
Thirsty.
One of the points of this article that unsettled me quite a bit and I'm still sitting with is the identity, actually, like, taking on a settler identity and what that means. Because in some ways, I think their article is fairly binary. You're either indigenous to this place or you are a settler. And I don't disagree with that. And also, my mother is not from this country. And depending on who you talk to in the family, you know, she and her family are either refugees or political asylees and didn't want to come to the United States and didn't expect to stay here, but were not able to return. And so my immediate read, like when I read that at first, I felt defensive.
Yeah.
I felt really defensive. And I'm flipping papers here because I've got the article in front of me.
And that kind of migration, even though it's under the umbrella, in this article at least, under the umbrella of settler, it is described as coerced immigration.
Yeah, right. So right here, I have highlighted the section where it says, colonial subjects who are displaced by external colonialism as well as racialized and minoritized by internal colonialism, still occupy and settle stolen indigenous land. Settlers are diverse, not just of white European descent, and include people of color, even from other colonial contexts, right? So, you know, I identify as a Latinx person of color. And so my first reaction to that was, oh,
yeah,
that feels not okay. Now, my father and his family are definitely some fucking settlers, Irish settlers. And that feels easier to own for me, but...
So this funny thing just happened. We were recording and we weren't. And all of the things we said are lost forever. But in the spirit of Marcel Duchamp, when the sculpture of the bicycle wheel was lost the third time, or rather when it was lost the second time, he replaced it a third time and said, "It's just as good as the first one."
That's some arty shit.
That
right
is some
there.
Arty shit.
Some
and I'm gonna evoke that. What we're about to say is just as good as what was lost to wherever that recording went. Talking about having some hard feelings reading this, there was something that I read that came up with me. So in this article, Tuck and Yang talk about moves to innocence and how people try to avoid the responsibility of being a settler. And there's one part called "Free Your Mind and the Rest Will Follow," which I think that's in vogue.
I think so.
I'm pretty sure that's in vogue.
Would you call us elder millennials?
Elder millennials.
That we should know things like that.
Yeah. We were made in the 80s.
That's right.
Yep. The best decade.
Oh my God. No. The worst. The decade that set the stage for the neoliberal hellhole shithole dumpster fire that we are currently experiencing right now.
Gosh, the kids that were born in this decade, well, this is their 80s.
Yep.
Wow.
Yay.
So anyways, free your mind and the rest will follow. There's a sentence here. "We wonder whether another settler move to innocence is to focus on decolonizing the mind, as if it were the sole activity of decolonization, to allow conscientization to stand in for the more uncomfortable task of relinquishing stolen land." And I read that the first time, and I was like, but I'm reading all this stuff, and I'm doing all this thinking. This is good work, damn it.
You are doing it.
I'm a good person. How dare you? I got my Karen hair on and got real indignant and wanted to talk to the manager. And it took me a while to come around to it. And actually, I was rereading this. It was the thing that I missed, the key operator in this statement, which was as if it were the soul activity. And so that really changed it for me. It's okay to obviously learn about this. We hope you're learning about this. We had to learn a lot about this and all that. But it's kind of useless if it doesn't then turn into action that is in the movement of decolonization.
Yes, yes.
And so that said, and I think that's where, kind of tying it back into the purpose of this, I think that's where social work is going to fit in. And it also reminds me of another resource that we've got too, that is a pretty cool website, Decolonize All the Things. You want to tell us a little bit about it?
I would love to, yeah.
Awesome.
Decolonize All the Things is what it sounds like. So it's a great resource just to like learn and grow and read, but they're also sort of practical tools and tips about what it could look like to decolonize all the things. It's the project of Shay Akil McLean, who is a queer trans man, racialized as Black, who is a PhD biology student and kind of all around badass. You can follow them on Twitter at hood_biologist.
I do.
Highly recommend it.
I've learned a lot from them.
Yeah. Very good. Very good. So he lifts up a couple of Audre Lorde quotes actually at the beginning, kind of the about section of his site that I want to share because I think they're just excellent and, you know, really relevant to this conversation.
And Audre Lorde's awesome.
Audre Lorde is awesome. Is this, did we lose the bit where I talked about my Goodreads challenge?
We did, and you have to repeat it. Because you talked about we could just read Audre Lorde books.
I did. I was like, we could just read Audre Lorde on the podcast. That would be fine.
So how's that going to work out for your Goodreads challenge this 2019? How's that going?
So for anyone who may not know, Goodreads is a website where you can log the books you've read, write reviews, read reviews, be in sort of book club communities, and set challenges for yourself. Well, last year, 2018, I set the biggest, longest book challenge that I have ever set, 24 books in a year. And I was successful, which was kind of a huge feat because I was in school for part of that time.
I was going to say, I got to gas you up because you were in grad school for half that year.
I did. That's awesome. Yes. Yeah. And I didn't count any of the books that I had to read for school because I was mad about that.
And honest.
And honest. I did read a lot of graphic novels. And
that's literature, though. That counts.
So I was so proud of myself that I upped my book limit or my book challenge to 30 books for 2019.
Nice.
So we're in September, and I am at
the end of September.
The end of September. We're in the middle of September, and I have completed 8 books. So you can find me in the young adult section of the public library this October, November, and December as I frantically try to get myself to 30.
Also, now you will know if we don't have another episode until January, what we're doing with ourselves.
They're like, oh, that bitch is reading.
Yeah.
That's what she's doing.
It's okay. I have a similar trajectory where I thought I was doing really awesome last year and upped my Goodreads challenge. I think last year was 20. And so I was like, boot-de-doo, piece of cake. What you got, Goodreads? And then I upped it to 40. And I've read 8 books. So, yeah, I'm right in the shit with you, as Gordon Ramsay would say.
Yeah, you know, and it's, you know, I'll get back to the point here in a second. But, you know, I think I feel some shame around not having read more.
What is that telling you? What is that shame?
That's something about me.
Right? And that's what we talked about, though. We mentioned this. Anna Sewell says that shame is a tool of of colonizers.
Mm-hmm.
It's a shame of, fuck me. It's a tool of the
Take a breath.
It's a tool of the colonizer.
Yeah. So back to Audre Lorde. So first, quote, without community, there is no liberation. But community must not mean a shedding of our differences, nor the pathetic pretense that these differences do not exist. So I just think we could probably open multiple conversations with that quote.
Mm-hmm.
We're living in a moment where diversity, 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 that's sort of the buzzword. Actually, it's been for a little while.
Go to a diversity training. Oh, our organization is instantly better, and you actually don't change any of the way you do things.
Yeah, or holding on to this idea of being colorblind, which we've addressed in previous episodes. It's actually good to acknowledge that we're different and to dig into that and what
difference
that means.
Difference is a big, big, awesome thing to acknowledge.
Yeah. And this other piece, this quote... As Paulo Freire shows so well in Pedagogy of the Oppressed, the true focus of revolutionary change is never merely the oppressive situations which we seek to escape, but that piece of the oppressor which is planted deep within us and which knows only the oppressor's tactics and the oppressor's relationships. That resonates with me as we have this conversation about what decolonization means, what it means to decolonize, because it's external work. It's also some deep self work. We have all been indoctrinated into this system of patriarchy and white supremacy and capitalism, and that shit lives in our bones. And even on the best of days, I know that I do things that perpetuate that system. And a decolonization process would mean every day taking a look at that.
It does. And again, that it's kind of tiptoeing back towards some guilt about the things you didn't do. And I'm not trying to absolve any of us over the responsibility to move towards decolonization, but I do want to at least lift up a quote from Wretched of the Earth. Again, that's Franz Fanon's text about decolonization. This very brief sentence, at a descriptive level, any decolonization is a success. And that was kind of refreshing. I actually highlighted it.
Can you read that again?
Yeah, I can. At a descriptive level, any decolonization is a success. And I think that, again, all this being on a continuum means that tells me that this work that I'm doing on at least learning how to move through the world in a way that will ultimately lead to decolonization is worthwhile. Mm-hmm. You have to learn how to do it first. And so, again, that goes back to that operator is like, it can't just be the sole action that you do, just kind of educating yourself and learning about it, but it has to lead to action. So again, that sort of precursory work of learning about it is still moving towards success.
Yeah. Gosh, it's life's work, right?
Yeah.
On Decolonize All the Things, there's a great post piece written called Decolonization, What Ought to Be, and we'll link directly to that. But I've read this a couple times. I've printed it out. I have it in front of me, and I've just been thinking about some of these points. It's a one that when I read it, I was like, holy shit, I got to read this again, is may our everydayness be a perpetual questioning of Europe's claim to have a grip on what defines what is and what ought to be. And I don't remember if this got cut out or not, but when, you know, we were talking about Elizabethan poor laws.
And the worthy poor.
And the worthy poor. And that's something that, you know, you learn in social work school. And like that framework for who deserves charity and how much charity is imported from Europe. And we still use it as a way of providing services to people today. And this, you know, we need to be questioning that.
We punish people who are not poor enough and are not worthy of our help.
Yeah. We need to be asking the question, who decided that this is what ought to be?
Yeah.
There's another, again, also pull in from Decolonize All the Things. It says here, embody decolonization, live the language, meet needs in your community, interrogate the things taken for granted, reflect on how you can build healthier relationships, interrogate what is, what has been, think about, discuss, and try to do and to bring about what ought to be. So, you know, this is taking what can feel like a really big topic into something hopefully a little bit more tangible for people. I love this quote too. We're not going to eliminate imperialism by shouting insults at it. That one got me into the feels about the echo chamber that is Facebook and the internet. And I think also the folks that lots of people that I respect in my personal life, and sometimes even me, guilty of talking shit about a system or a problem or a situation, calling it out, but then offering no tangible steps forward. Right. That's not really who I want to be.
I think also shouting insults at imperialism has some pretty thick skin.
Fuck yeah.
They don't give a shit about it. So yeah.
You know, decolonization is a process that it's long, it's painstaking, it's messy. And that was something that another moment of unsettling for me when I read decolonizing is not a metaphor, decolonize is not a metaphor. It's just this, immediately I wanted to jump to this place of, well, what would it look like to like return land, and what will happen to everybody who's been here and for a long time, even if they are settlers, like where are they going to go? And what does this mean for me? I don't actually own any land. What can I give back if I don't own land? And you know, what about other people who don't own land? I just got caught in this spiral of like, this isn't really possible because it seems impractical. And you know, that's a deflection and it's not helpful. And, you know, in this article, he talks about the discordance between what we say and what we do has to change. It doesn't matter that I don't know the answer to that question.
That would maybe even undermine the way that we approach the movement to decolonization, too, as if you're more worried about the outcome of it than the process itself. Yeah.
Another piece of this article that really spoke to me, and I'm pretty certain spoke to you because of your work in housing, but it says here, decolonization starts with working out all of the different ways we can interact with others without denying their self-determination. Social work buzzword. Decolonization starts with questioning the notions of private property and endlessly seeking profit and how we can build different relations. You know, you'd mentioned in a conversation before about how that when you work with landlords, right, and like housing discrimination, and at the heart of all this is this notion of like private property.
I think when the hardest part for me is because I do work in basically keeping people in their homes, and I work in housing, and like my whole idea about the immorality of land ownership altogether is going in this development of this consciousness and this awareness of it and this action that I want to take is absolutely in the opposite direction of where we're going as a society, as like more land is consolidated by people. People can't even afford to buy land to live on, and they're just being, and that's all fucking immoral and wrong too. But then I'm also struggling with this idea that none of it should even be happening in the first place, because you shouldn't be allowed to have the land. It's not yours
it's not ours to own.
Yeah. And I have yet to reconcile that, and I struggle with it a lot, because sometimes I'm just like, oh, well, let's just go burn their fucking apartment buildings down if they want to kick people out. We'll really give them an eviction. And obviously I can't do that. I'm not going to do that.
He's not going to do that, nor has he ever done that.
I've never planned to. I don't even know how to set a fire. I was never given a name. It's a deep cut. So it's just hard to really wrap my mind around all of it. And it is immense, and it's unsettling, and it's uncomfortable, and it makes me mad. It makes me mad I don't have the answer to it. But that's part of the process.
Yeah, this is uncomfortable. Yeah. It's just uncomfortable. And it should be. We're asking you guys to be uncomfortable. By you guys, I particularly mean settlers. Yeah. This conversation is different.
Non-Indigenous people.
For Indigenous folks. Yeah.
You know, talking about it being uncomfortable reminds me, we did one more thing. We watched this really cool webinar by Anna Sewell, who is a Red River Métis Indigenous person in Canada. And this webinar was hosted by Everyday Feminism. And
I just dropped my computer. I'm sorry, everyone. What is Everyday Feminism again?
Funny you should ask, as you are not making any commotions over there on your side of the table.
My bad.
Everyday Feminism is a website that posts a lot of articles, guidance. It's a pretty good information resource for all things feminism. They keep a pretty good focus on intersectional feminism at that. And sometimes it's just how-tos and self-awareness for how you can do better feminism in your everyday life.
Everyday life.
Hence the name.
Bring it home.
Yeah. But Anna Sewell, in this webinar, Practical Decolonization, How to Live It Daily, talked about how this is heavy work and requires a lot of self-reflection and action. And it's not supposed to be fun.
Mm-mm.
You're not going to get pats on the back. You're not going to feel good doing this process and working towards it. And I think that's what makes it so important, is like you have to be brave and courageous and determined to do it, because everything will want you to not do it.
Yeah. Get in touch with your values, because if you want to be in alignment with them and walk with integrity, likely if your values are anywhere close to mine, it means sitting in this discomfort and doing this work.
Yeah. And I sit in that discomfort a lot. Like I said, everything from like the industry I work in and housing to like the fact that I've got the paperwork, I've seen where my ancestors came from. They are all just white settlers, you know, started in Virginia and kind of worked their way up through Southern Virginia and up to through Kentucky. And then the other side of my family, they're immigrants, but they're immigrants to a land that they maybe didn't have a right to immigrate to.
Yeah. I mean, in Eve Tuck's article, there's no such thing as an immigrant. You're a settler
right,
or not.
So, you know, undisputably, that's who I am. And, that was not a fun process coming around to being able to call myself that without shame being attached to it.
I just wanted to say a couple other things about the webinar. She talked about some practical things people can do. One of those things was to learn and practice your ancestral ways. So that's something I suggest for folks who are listening who are not Indigenous. If you're not already sort of connected to your ancestral practices, explore what those are. And I think that connects to conversations around cultural appropriation, because I think when people are not connected to where they came from, but you're looking for connection, it's really easy to take things that don't belong to you. And I remember I've gotten into a few conversations with folks of color around like our ability to appropriate, right? And that's, we have to also pay attention to the things that we're taking that don't belong to us.
And that's hard too. We talked about this, you and I did the other day after we watched the webinar. Like, as I just told you, my family is all settlers, and I think our ancestral practice is the take shit that's not ours. And so what does that mean? You know, and I was stuck because like my most immediate family member who emigrated is English. And I'm thinking, like, fucking English people have been doing shit, taking land for 1,000 years. Like, how far back do I have to go with it? And I kind of came around to the fact that, like, as important as it is to connect with your ancestral practices and all that, it's also never too late to start developing new practices that the people that come after us are going to benefit from. And I think that's one part that's especially valuable to white people is, like, start now developing the identity of people who fight for justice and who have responsibility over these capitalist, white supremacist, colonialist structures. And the legacy that you can leave behind, that you were somebody who fought the, like, one, piss in the wind at your ancestors who set this up, but two, also, you are working to dismantle those things.
Yeah, I mean, you need to have, like, role models. You need to have Ann Braden's and John Brown's and, like, white people to look up to.
Yeah, those are the people whose ancestral ways I want to practice. The sacking of the Harper's Ferry sort of shit.
Something else that really struck me from the practical decolonization webinar was that one thing you need to do is to, like, literally locate yourself and socially locate yourself. And I hope you weren't going to talk about this, I'm stealing your thunder, but part of doing that is knowing whose ancestral lands you're on. And there's an amazing resource for doing so. It's called native-land.ca. You can go online and put in where you live, and it'll tell you whose lands you're on.
I don't want to end our talk about the webinar, but there is one thing that just fits in so well from a book we've talked about before, which is Decolonizing Social Work, which is written and edited by Mel Gray, John Coates, Michael Yellowbird, and Tiani Hetherington. In the end of the book, in the conclusion, continuing the decolonization agenda, and they're talking about decolonization and social work, and they say, decolonizing social work requires that we either discard colonial names or point them out for what they are. And I think kind of locating yourself as a social worker is one way that we can do this, using the tool, like you said, nativeland.ca.
Yeah, and do this as often and everywhere that you can. Yeah. And do it earnestly, right? Yeah. So when you're starting a meeting or a workshop or a conference, start with land acknowledgments, but not just, you know, so glad to be here today. We are on Cherokee lands. All right, great, thanks for coming, blah, blah, blah. But actually spend some time thinking about what that means.
Yeah.
And locating yourself too, right, socially. So if you're a settler, naming that.
Yeah.
That's important.
And part of that might be something else that came from that webinar, which was reevaluating your values.
Mm-hmm. So kind of an amalgamation of all of the resources we absorbed for the purpose of this conversation. You know, I was constantly thinking about how do we make this tangible for social workers. And I think we've tried to do a good job of that throughout. You know, I think very explicitly, social workers need to know what this word means, not use it flippantly, and understand that when we talk about decolonizing social work, the end game is returning land.
The end game is there is no social work.
There's no social work, right, because it's...
I mean, you say that already, right? If you work at a nonprofit, you're always saying, oh, our job is to work ourselves out of a job. Think of it in a different way. Social work can be used towards decolonization, but when we get to that point, social work won't exist. Mm-hmm. You can't decolonize social work so long as we are in a settler society.
And actually, you know, profiting off poverty and oppression and keeping ourselves employed to the nonprofit industrial complex, right?
I mean, that is definitely some settler shit.
So, you know what that word means. Don't use it without using it in that way. Know whose land you're on. Do land acknowledgements and acknowledge also your position on the land. So if you are a settler, then you should name that. These are things you can do at the beginning of a lot of spaces. Something else that stuck out to me as we were digesting all of this too was that keeping people separate is also a tool of colonialism. Mm-hmm. And one way that can manifest is through the prison industrial complex. Is that we remove people, prisons, private prisons, but also ICE detention centers. Mm-hmm. We remove people from their families. We strip people from their communities and we isolate them in this way. And, you know, the opposite of that, right, is community and connection and keeping people together. And that reminded me of our conversation around dual relationships and around social workers choosing not to live in the communities where they work mm-hmm. when really they need to. That's a colonial tool of isolation. You know, interrogate that. Think about that in your life.
One thing I want to kind of, as we wind down here, there is another just short place I want to read from Decolonizing Social Work to kind of, I think it summarizes a lot of things and also kind of points to some practical things that we continue to do as social workers until decolonization. And they write, "Decolonization can be seen as an extension of the critical tradition in social work, such as structural, feminist, and anti-oppressive perspectives in environmental social work, that draws attention to the oppressive and exploitative elements inherent in societies." So as long as your social work practice is anti-capitalist, is pro-feminist, is pro-immigrant, is
it's about collective liberation.
Labor-friendly, it's about collective liberation. Like, you can form social work as a vehicle towards decolonization.
Yes.
And that's what we want. That's what the purpose of this podcast is to talk about. That's what we are emphasizing. So, yeah.
So this is some heavy-ass shit.
It is.
Thank you guys for going on this journey with us. And again, just want to lift up that we're also learning.
We are learning in public with you. And we'd love to hear your feedback about this. If we said something that you feel like we got the read wrong, let us know. Again, this has got to be a development that keeps going. We're by no means experts in this. I mean, we barely have a grasp on it to talk about it.
Just enough to know that we have a responsibility.
Yeah, to talk about it and to plan after we've talked about it. But yeah, so I think, we have had a hiatus of sorts, but we are on the ground moving. So our next episode is going to be pretty awesome too, right?
Yeah, I'm excited. I think we're planning an episode around labor and labor organizing and labor unions and social work.
That's going to be dope. Mm-hmm. That's nice. So yeah, so hopefully it won't be another 6 months before you hear from us, because like I said, we've got that in the works already. But thank you again, and thanks for sticking with us, because this is related to us as we're being social workers, even though we're still talking about land. But that's all right. Related.
That's right. And
what are you going to read next for your Goodreads challenge?
Oh my gosh. I'm reading there's a little book about restorative justice that I'm reading. I'm almost done with that. So I need to finish that.
You're reading Illness as Metaphor.
Illness as Metaphor by Susan Sontag. That shit's not light.
It's not bedtime reading. It's not bedtime reading. It is not.
So I think maybe next it might be a graphic novel.
You need a graphic novel.
I need a graphic novel.
You need something to buffer it. You do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Take care, everybody. Until next time.
Until next time. Thanks. Bye.
You've been listening to Decolonize Social Work, a podcast about social work, oppression, and liberation. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, and SoundCloud at Decolonize SW, and on Instagram at Decolonize Social Work.